Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hello, everybody. Hello again. And Peggy Orenstein's second thoughts about breast cancer awareness. Our first topic this hour, the writer who thought she was cured of breast cancer in her 30s, used to be a loud and proud voice for early detection, but today, not so much. Her New York Times Magazine piece on Sunday headlined "The Problem with Pink." Maybe you saw it. So let's talk to Peggy Orenstein about what she's come to question about the pink ribbon approach to raising awareness, possibly at the expense of researching an actual cure. Peggy Orenstein, welcome back to WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me on again.
And let's start, Peggy, by talking some science here. The early view of the disease was that breast cancer was one disease in which a rogue cell kept multiplying until it metastasizes and spreads to other organs. That's our basic view of cancer. So it made sense to try and catch it early, usually with mammograms, because the fear was that by the time you could feel it, it was too late. But as you lay out in your piece, that's not the current theory of the disease, right?
Not always. The idea was that all cancer behaved the same way and that it always worked in the sequential fashion where it started with one cell, got bigger, 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 and then at some defined, well, undefined but definable point would jump. And it was important. I realized that a lot of people didn't understand that primary cancer is not what kills you, that cancer in the breast is not what kills you. What kills you is when your cancer jumps and goes to your bones or your other organs. So early detection, the theory, which goes back to the 19th century, was just if you found it and cut it off before that happened, you'd be fine. But what we now know is that breast cancer is a family of diseases, and some of them are very aggressive and have already metastasized by the time they can be, you know, so-called caught early, and others would never harm a woman in her lifetime, even, and those, mammography is very good at catching the latter kind, that would not be harmful, but would just sort of either poke along or not, you know, or stay where it was or go away. So there's a whole range of what it means to have breast cancer.
So does early detection matter? Have you come to decide that it does or it doesn't, or it depends who you are?
It kind of depends on the kind of cancer you have. So what I think the issues have been are that the benefits of mammography have been vastly overpromised, and its harms and limits have been almost undiscussed, so that women are aware and believe that mammography saves lives, and in a small fraction of the cases of cancer that it finds, it will avert death. It makes a difference. 138,000 cancers, breast cancers, are found each year on mammography. For between 3% and 13% of those breast cancers, mammography will make a difference. It will help the person for whom who is diagnosed. The other cases would be equally treatable or equally not treatable, whether they were found via the mammogram or found later on.
So, listeners, I'm sure many of you listening right now read Peggy Orenstein's New York Times Magazine piece this weekend, and maybe you have a question about the science or the medical politics or any aspect of it that you want to bring up or tell your story. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. We keep monitoring the comments page and bring some questions on from there. For Peggy Orenstein, her piece called "The Problem with Pink." And as I'm sure won't surprise you, when we've talked about these studies that question the need for mammograms before age 50, we hear from listeners that early mammograms save their lives. And that was your initial response to the studies. I think that's one of the things that makes your article so interesting. Somebody who develops an informed opinion and then switch sides.
Yeah,
but that's really you,
it,
right?
Wrote about it.
What?
Not only developed it, but wrote about it.
Yeah.
So I have to go out publicly and say I was wrong. I was first diagnosed when I was 35 years old via a mammogram. At the time, it was still somewhat common to do what they called a baseline mammogram, one before you were going to start at 40. And I thought, okay, because my doctor told me to. At the time, I thought, okay, caught it early, saved my life. Over time, I realized, a number of things about mammography in your 40s. Well, I wasn't even 40, but in your 40s, that, first of all, no individual woman can really know if the mammogram made a difference for her. It may have. It may not have. So that's one piece. But the other, and of course for me, the other piece was that I had a recurrence 15 years later. So, you know, there's that. But the other side of it is that it comes with a great deal of harm to people, and we don't talk about that. And again, the issue is not, don't do mammography. The issue is when we start and the interval at which we do it, and what the downsides are that women aren't hearing about in terms of overdiagnosis, overtreatment, and those words tend to just kind of blur in our heads because they sound really medically, and it was really important to me to put a face on what that means for people.
Mm-hmm. And so, for example, some of the stats in your article, for every 2,000 women screened annually over 10 years, one life is prolonged. But 10 healthy women are given diagnoses of breast cancer and unnecessarily treated, often with therapies that themselves have life-threatening side effects. So that's really daunting, and I'm sure leaves many women paralyzed in deciding whether mammography is worth the risk or is just something to avoid, even though they may not be catching something that they could catch.
Well, and again, I think, there was a panel that gave recommendations in 2009, and there are recommendations that have been used in other countries, other similar countries to ours, in terms of risk throughout the world, pretty effectively, and that's start at 50 and do it every other year. But when those recommendations came out, they came out at the height of the debate about healthcare in 2009, and they just got slammed. There was an immediate, they were seized upon by those who were against the Obama healthcare plan as being, an example of how we were going to ration healthcare at the expense of our wives and mothers and sisters and daughters. And women who had decades of messaging, public health messaging about mammography saving lives, had come to believe, according to surveys, that mammography actually prevented cancer, didn't just detect it. And so all of that came together to create this perfect storm of fury. And those recommendations just they were gone within about 2 days. The Obama administration backpedaled that they weren't changing their policies, and nothing changed. And it was so unfortunate because it was a very sensible finding based on really hard evidence. And there were really good reasons having to do with the limits of mammography as well as its benefits that just went completely undiscussed in that. And that, I think, was to the detriment of women's health.
Listeners, your questions for Peggy Orenstein. The problems with pink, her New York Times Magazine story this weekend, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And let's get to the pink. The movement, the awareness, Susan G. Komen and everything else, because one of the main issues in your piece is questioning the allocation of those funds and mm-hmm. whether, and when we think about the pink movement, we think about things like the race for the cure, and cure is in the title. But one of the problems that you see is that the money is not being allocated as much to cure as you would like rather than to awareness, right?
So the Komen Foundation, which is the largest breast cancer foundation charity and one of the largest charities in the country, they pull in about, it was $420 million a year, and 16% of that goes to research. And the bulk of what they pull in goes to education, largely about awareness, which means largely about mammography. And I think that the people who do the races and the runs and the walks and the climbs and the, I don't know what they're doing, drinking, whatever, they're pub crawls, are not really aware that only 16 cents of each dollar that they raise is going to research. It's a lot of money when you put it all together, but it's only 16 cents on your dollar.
Would you rather see that percentage upped?
Personally, yes. I think but at the same time, it's not, one of the points I make in the piece is it's not only about more money and shifting that allocation. It's also about how we think about you know, where in research that money should be spent, and really thinking about the two ends of the spectrum. You know, I think one of the problems with PINC is that it has made us somewhat complacent. We think we're doing something by getting our mammograms. We think we're doing something by buying yogurt, you know, with the PINC lid or whatever it is. And it's created a culture that is simultaneously a culture of fear that's over-hyping breast cancer and amping up our terror of it so that we're making bad medical decisions and also not effectively addressing the areas that really most need it, which are the two ends of the breast cancer spectrum, figuring out which women really do need treatment on one end for less aggressive disease and figuring out what to do for women with metastatic disease who are the ones who are dying.
Let's take a phone call. Linda in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Linda.
Oh, good morning. I wanted to ask Ms. Orenstein, my mother had breast cancer, but the type where they did a modified radical many years ago, no recurrence. That is not what she died of. But I have three sisters who were diagnosed with DCIS, all of whom took different treatment paths, the most recent one being, the removal, a quadrenectomy, I think they called it, with tamoxifen for 5 years. Mm-hmm. Have you learned anything new? I heard that that is a precancer, not an actual cancer.
Yeah. Ooh, good.
I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you. Well, and is that the same, Peggy? Are you up on this enough to say if DCIS, which is relatively new terminology that I know women are hearing, is the same as what they call stage zero cancer?
Yes, and I write a lot about DCIS in the piece. DCIS means ductal carcinoma in situ, which is a kind of really a risk factor for cancer, a precancer that is in the ducts. And in the majority of cases of DCIS, and we don't really, it depends, DCIS also is more than, like breast cancer itself, it's a family of diseases, but the estimates I have heard have ranged from 53% to 95% of DCIS cases, depending on the kind of DCIS, will never break out of the ducts, which means that they will never spread, they can never become metastatic, they can never become lethal. And and before mammography, it was virtually unheard of. It's one of the things that mammography is really good at detecting, and when they find it, they treat it. And I have really come. One of the researchers I talked to, Laura Esserman at University of California, San Francisco, said it's like people are coming in with high cholesterol, and we're giving them heart bypass surgery. You know, it's massive overtreatment, and one of the things that we so desperately need to do, because we don't know whose DCIS is going to progress to invasive cancer at this point, is figure out how to make that distinction. That would be a huge. And what's happening in the PINC movement is that DCIS patients are treated as triumphs of early detection, when really most of the time they're casualties of early detection. People who have been told they have cancer go through all kinds of treatment, never feel healthy again, always feel at risk, and may not have, you know, any particular increased risk at all. And to me, I feel like DCIS, we're going to look back at it someday the way we now look back as the caller said, you know, the radical mastectomy, like, oh, wow, that's the distant history. That was really barbaric. And I hope that one of the things that I wanted to do was have people bring their goodwill and donations and all of that to bear more specifically. And this is one of the places. DCIS people should not want their daughters and sisters and granddaughters to have to live with the uncertainty of whether they needed to do what they needed to do.
Kamala in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Peggy Orenstein. Hi.
Hi, it's actually Kamala.
Sorry, sorry.
Hi, Peggy.
Oh, you know each other.
Hi. I had a question. First of all, I didn't tell this to the screener, but my mom had breast cancer, and she very dutifully had mammograms like every year, and the mammograms never detected her cancer. And even once they knew she had it because it had metastasized, they still had a hard time finding it actually in her breast because the part in her breast was so small. But what I was calling to ask about is that I had a mammogram, and it was not conclusive or whatever, so then I was asked to have a sonogram, I guess, ultrasound. And I was wondering, like, so if the next step is having an ultrasound, why don't we just go right to ultrasound and skip mammography with its radiation?
What a great question.
Great question. Yeah, great question, Kamala, who I went to college with. Hi. And I'm really sorry about your mom. It is true that there are both, that there are types of cancer that never show a primary tumor in the breast, and also that mammography, again, especially in young women, misses a percentage of cancer as well. So you have both false positive and false negative that are possible. In terms of why we don't use ultrasound or MRI, is another thing, on everybody, because they find all kinds of stuff, and a lot. And you know, one of the things I'm talking about is that catching it ever earlier is not necessarily going to help us. We may not be able to screen our way out of this dilemma for the average risk woman. And ultrasound and MRI might catch cancer, but they're also going to catch way more junk in your breast, and you're going to end up having tons of unnecessary biopsies.
That's what happened to me.
Yeah, on an average woman. And again, I'm not talking about a high-risk person. Then you have a whole different kettle of fish. My article is about, and I'm high-risk, and you are high-risk, but I'm talking about the average woman between, you know, 50 and 75 and or 40 and 80 or whatever you want to say, what that person should do, a person at average risk.
Kamala, thank you very much. That's a great question. And Diana in Maplewood, you're on WNYC. Hi, Diana.
Hi. I just wanted to weigh in. I had bilateral breast cancer, stage one invasive, but it had not reached my lymph nodes. So I was given 6 weeks of radiation, and that was it. And it's been 15 years, and I'm fine. But I owe that to my doctor, who said to me when he gave me the diagnosis, number one, this is not a death sentence. Number two, you do not have to have your breast removed. And he said, you know, it's not a death sentence. I will help you. And he did two lumpectomies. He did the, underarm, took out the lymph nodes. I had 6 weeks of radiation once I was stronger, and I didn't even have tamoxifen, and it's been 15 years. My sister was diagnosed 2 years later with in situ, and she wanted to have two radical
mastectomies.
Yeah. Thank you. And her doctor was willing to do it, and I said, that's outrageous. And I made her come to New York, see my doctor, who said he wouldn't even do it for her. It was so unnecessary. So I think a lot of this depends on the information you're getting from your doctor, and some of them are so scrupulous and careful and thoughtful, and others just are not. You know, you want to whack them off, we'll whack them off. So I think people have to be very careful about who they go to.
Well, you're absolutely right, and I think that some of that comes from, you know, a physician's personal experience, both in practice and in life. And one of the things that I wrote about in the piece was the rise in double mastectomies when people are diagnosed with cancer in one breast. In other words, taking off the other healthy breast. And cases like your sister's, where women are diagnosed with DCIS in one breast, there's been 188% uptick in the percentage of women who opt to have both breasts removed with that diagnosis, which, you know, as we've seen, is really, you know, likely a risk factor for cancer. And not even, I mean, one of the things that researchers said to me was, if women could just see that DCIS is not an emergency, they don't have to rush on it, they can think about it. And for invasive stage one cancer, like what you had, like what I had, the uptick in double mastectomy has been 150%. And when I talked to the researcher who did those studies, he said it wasn't that women were getting genetic counseling, it wasn't even that they were getting medical advice. It was based on their perception of risk, which was that they thought they had 30% chance of getting breast cancer in the other breast over the next 10 years, when the chance was actually 5%. So it was there. I think that one of the big issues in terms of the cultural piece of this is that our anxiety and fear about breast cancer, which is real, it's a really scary disease. I don't want to minimize it. 40,000 women a year die of it. But how we manage that fear and how we understand risk and how we approach it is really important to making good medical decisions and good funding decisions.
Peggy Orenstein's important piece in the New York Times Magazine, Rethinking Some of the Science and Medical Practice Around Breast Cancer and Breast Cancer Evaluation, called The Problem with Pink, again, in the New York Times Magazine. It also includes a really good, I like that shorthand little description of the different types of breast cancer and which kinds of treatment they tend to respond to. I think that's something that people very rarely get to see a couple of layers down in the scientific literature. So, and obviously a huge response to you on the phone. So thank you very much for coming on and talking about this with us.
My great pleasure, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And listeners, you can keep talking to each other about this on our webpage, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And coming up next, how progressives are sizing up Mayor Bloomberg and the New York City mayoral hopefuls. Stay with us.